Let's begin our session today by reintroducing the newest king of the southern kingdom of Judah, and that is a man by the name of Amaziah. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter number 14. Verse number 1 says, "In the second year of Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel, Amaziah, the son of Jehoash, king of Judah, began to reign." And I would put that as 807 BC. He was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jehoiadan of Jerusalem. And he did what was right in the eyes of he who is, yet not like David his father. He did in all things as Josiah his father had done. So he's not quite the same person David was in a lot of respects. He is a little bit like his dad, who started out well but was willing to let things slide. In fact, that was one of the last things that happened in Jehoash's life, is that he agreed that worship of other gods and goddesses should be allowed to be engaged in the kingdom of Judah. And he was under the judgment of God very shortly thereafter. Verse 4 gives some specific. It says, "The high places were not removed. The people still sacrificed and made offerings on the high places." We've seen this in other transitions, and I shared with you then, I don't think we can be absolutely positive what is meant by this, as to whether or not it's saying that they allowed the Judeans to keep worshiping other gods and goddesses at different sites around the country. They just basically turned a blind eye to it. Or are they talking about the worship altars to he who is genuine God that popped up from time to time around the country because people didn't always feel good about going to the temple complex, partly because of situations like Athaliah being in charge. So there's only supposed to be one place where the sacrifices are taking place, and that's supposed to be the Jerusalem temple. And so is it possible, what is being said here, is he turned a blind eye to these unauthorized independent worship sites for he who is? I tend to move in that direction, although I acknowledge that the other is very possible as well. Now, verse 4 talks about his response to his father's assassination. You remember his dad got hurt during the invasion of the Syrians up to Judea and Jerusalem. And some of his servants decided they didn't like him because of his killing of the son of the late high priest, his own cousin, because of the prophecies that had been made against the king and the kingdom because of those illicit actions. So his own servants, that is Jehoash's own servants, killed him. And so here is his son, Amaziah, coming to the throne, and he has to deal with those assassins. Verse 5, "As soon as the royal power was firmly in his hand," so after he went through all the ceremonies and he knew where he stood with most of the leadership, he struck down his servants who had struck down the king, his father. So once he was firmly in charge, he tracked down, arrested, put on trial, and then executed the servants of Jehoash that had assassinated him. Verse 6, though, says, "But he did not put to death the children of the murderers, according to what is written in the book of the law of Moses, where he who is commanded, 'Fathers shall not be put to death because of their children, nor shall children be put to death because of their fathers. Each one shall die for his own sin.'" And that's a quote from the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 24, verse 16. And it is a principle that I think helps us develop the proper concept of how God deals with sin. God does not condemn any of us to hell for the sins of our fathers. Adam and Eve's sin did not send any of us to hell. It was our own choice to engage in sin that put us on that very bad track. It's just like the fact that the faith of our fathers does not save us from hell. That is an individual, personal choice that has to be made. And so God has that as his rule. And so it's also supposed to apply in matters of government and of justice in the event of murder. So the sons, the children of these assassins were not involved in the assassination plot, so they were spared. Now, at this point, we have to go back to chapter 13 and pick up some stories that we skipped over because I don't think we were quite ready for the timing of them. 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 14 is going to tell us about the final words and death of Elisha the prophet. And I think these events that we're about to talk about have to take place somewhere toward the end of the 800s BC, maybe the first few years of the beginning of the 700s BC. So 2 Kings 13, 14. Now, when Elisha had fallen sick with the illness of which he was to die, so he's effectively on his deathbed, Jehoash, king of Israel, went down to him and wept before him. So the king of northern Israel is grieved by the idea that the great prophet that he's grown up under is about to pass from this earth. He has a decent relationship with him. Even though he's still keeping up the golden calf worship, he has great respect and honor toward God's prophet in the northern kingdom. And he cries out to him, "My father, my father." So, Abi, Abi, which is a respectful way of addressing an older man. "The chariots of Israel and its horsemen." And that's a reference back to the story that Elisha had told many decades before about how Elijah left this earth, left this time period in the presence of the chariots of Israel, the angels of Israel, and how also Elisha, on one occasion, was in a town of Dothan, and he was surrounded by the Syrian forces that wanted to capture him because of his activities on God's behalf. And he wasn't afraid because he knew that the city was surrounded by the chariots and horsemen of God's heavenly army. And so those stories are out there. And the king of northern Israel says, "Oh, it's time for the chariots of Israel and its horsemen to come and get you." He knows that he's about to die. So Elisha said back to him, "Take a bow and arrows." And so he took a bow and arrows. And he said to the king of Israel, "Draw the bow." And he drew it. And Elisha laid his hands on the king's hands. So this is all taking place in a room with a window. And Elisha's apparently in bed, or maybe he's sitting up in a sick chair. And the king is following his instructions. He pulls the bow, draws the bow with the arrow in, knocked into it. And he says, "Open the window eastward." And he opened it. And then Elisha said, "Shoot." And he shot. And then Elisha said, "He who is his arrow of victory, the arrow of victory over Syria, for you shall fight the Syrians in Aphek until you've made an end of them." It would appear that there was an upcoming battle between the Israeli forces and the Syrian forces. Now, the Syrian forces are apparently coming toward Afek. There are several Afeks in Israel itself, but northern Israel, the Afek that seems to be mentioned here, is over by the Haifa Bay, over by the modern city of Haifa. And the Syrians would have apparently come around and down by the coastland in order to invade by that direction, which means they probably had some treaty agreements with Tyre and Sidon, because that's the direction you'd be coming from. So Elisha is prophesying on his deathbed, you are going to win in the upcoming fight at Afek. Then he said, verse 18, take the arrows. And he took them. And he said to the king of Israel, strike the ground with them. And so the king doesn't understand exactly why he's having to do all these things until Elisha reveals it. So when he's telling him, bring your bow and arrow, knock an arrow in the bow, open the window, shoot an arrow out, none of that made sense until Elisha explained it, that it was prophetic in nature. So when he tells him, hit the ground with those arrows, the king doesn't have an understanding as to what this is supposed to symbolize. So he just simply hits the ground three times with them. He figures that's enough. That's a nice symbolic number. It would have been better, though, if he'd gone on to 7 or 10 or 40. Just keep beating the ground until he was told to quit. Because this now is what Elisha says. Then the man of God was angry with him and said, you should have struck 5 or 6 times. Then you would have struck down Syria until you've made an end of it. But now you will strike down Syria only 3 times. So the symbolism was how many ever times he hit, that's how many victories he would get in the future. Verse number 20. So Elisha died, and they buried him. Now the bands of Moabites used to invade the land in the spring of the year. We've talked about this before. Many of the raiders would wait until you'd grown the crops and harvested them and were getting ready to store them away. That's when they would come in and steal your stuff, because then you did all the hard work. So evidently the Moabites are coming around the northern end of the Dead Sea and across the Jordan River, and they're coming into Israel, northern Israel, and are stealing the grain supplies and maybe some of the animals and fruit of the land. Now, as a man was being buried, behold, a marauding band was seen, and the man was thrown into the grave of Elisha. So the reason we were talking about the Moabites is just that they're running around on the landscape, taking stuff. And so there's a funeral that's going on when one of these marauding bands is approaching the town. And the moment that they see the marauding band coming, they just toss the body of the man into a nearby gravesite. And it just so happens it was the grave of apparently the recently buried Elisha. And as soon as the man touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood on his feet. So this is a post-death resurrection miracle of Elisha that is recorded in the text. Verse number 22. Now, Hazael, king of Syria, oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoahaz. That's just an overall statement that Hazael of the Syrians of Damascus kept Israel under their boot. But he who is was gracious to them and had compassion on them, and he turned toward them because of his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and would not destroy them, nor has he cast them from his presence until now. That line tells me exactly when this part of the book of 2 Kings was written. It was written around the time that northern Israel was being taken into their Assyrian captivity. And that would be in the later 700s. 723 is when Samaria is destroyed. But for many years before that, Assyria was kind of cutting apart bits and pieces of northern Israel and taking them away into captivity. So this part of it must have been written around that time. So God has his prophet remind the people that even though the Syrians and later the Assyrians are doing all sorts of nasty things to the Israeli people, God never lets it get completely out of hand. He always keeps it where he can keep his promises of always having the people of Israel as a representation of the promise made to Abraham. Verse number 24 says, when Hazael, king of Syria, died, Ben-Hadad, his son, became king in his place. Again, that's sometime late in the 800s, maybe the beginning of the 700s BC. Then Jehoahaz, the son of Jehoahaz, took again from Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, the cities that he had taken from Jehoahaz, his father, in war. Three times Joash defeated him and recovered the cities of Israel. So there's apparently some rollback of the Syrian invasion and annexing of northern Israel, and a little bit of a recovery of captured territory. And apparently the prophet Daniel was involved in predicting that this sort of stuff was going to happen. Daniel is a prophet contemporaneous with the last years of Elisha. Did I say Daniel? My apologies. I meant Jonah. Jonah is the prophet that we're going to be talking about before too much longer, and he is contemporaneous with the last years of Elisha, and he predicted that there would be a rollback of some of the Syrian invasion territories. Let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 25 now, and verse number 5, and talk about the things that are happening in the southern kingdom. It says, then Amaziah assembled the men of Judah and set them by fathers' houses under commanders of thousands and of hundreds and for all Judah and Benjamin. He mustered those 20 years old and upward, and he found that they were 300,000 choice men fit for war, able to handle spear and shield. So the current militia census in southern Judah is right around 300,000. 20 years up to in their 60s and 70s, as long as they're still capable of fighting in the battle. So 300,000 of them ready to go. But then verse 6, he hired also 100,000 mighty men of valor from Israel for 100 talents of silver. So he reaches out to his near neighbor to the north and says, I want more people on standby, ready to defend my kingdom. I would like to pay you 100 talents of silver. So later, the valuation of a talent is about 6,000 days' wages. So we're talking about 600,000 days' wages. To hire 100,000 mercenaries out of northern Israel. And this triggers the Lord stepping in and reminding Amaziah that he's supposed to be depending upon God and not armies. Verse 7, but a man of God came to him and said, O king, do not let the army of Israel go with you, for he who is not with Israel, with all those Ephraimites. So God is not on the side fully of northern Israel. He's working with them through his prophets, trying to get them to act better and to do the right thing, but they are still fighting him, even to the point that even when they quit worshiping Baal and Asherah, they still keep worshiping the golden calves. So you're not supposed to be unequally yoked with unbelievers. And so this is an example where God said, don't do it. Verse 8, but go, act, be strong for the battle. Why should you suppose that God will cast you down before the enemy? For God has power to help or to cast down. So God's response to Amaziah is, you need to trust me. Quit thinking that the battle belongs to people, to horses, to chariots, to strategists, to numbers of army members. The battle belongs to the Lord. Verse number 9. Amaziah said to the man of God, what shall we do about the 100 talents that I've given to the army of Israel? So immediately his mind goes to the fact, wait a second, I've already paid a huge amount of money for Israeli fighters to come down and assist us. That's a lot of money to lose. And the man of God answered, he who is able to give you much more than this. So if you trust God, you shouldn't be worried about the money that you threw away in your distrust of God. You should trust God by just trusting God. Reminds me of a couple of New Testament passages. One of them is when the apostles were talking to Jesus about wealth, and they were a little bit surprised that he said that rich people were not better off than everybody else, that they actually had a hard time getting into the kingdom. Eventually, they got around to talking on the topic of, well, you know what? We've given up everything. We've laid aside properties and our businesses, and we've been pursuing our apostleship with you instead of pursuing our career fields. What's going to be in it for us? And Jesus' response was, anyone that's left any of these things, properties, jobs, family members, in order to become one of his followers, he would receive back in this life many more times over that stuff, meaning he's now got the bigger family of believers, but also eternal life. So eternal life was the much more important thing than the finances and wealth that they were setting to one side. The other thing is in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus was trying to teach his followers that they were not to worry about the things of this world. You know, what am I going to eat? What am I going to drink? Where am I going to live? What am I going to wear? And Jesus teaches them that you need to trust God. And he finishes by saying, seek first the kingdom of God and its attendant righteousness, and all these other things will be added to you. All the other stuff will fall in place if you just trust God and do things his way. So that's what the prophet is telling Amaziah at this place. Don't worry about the 100,000 talents of silver that you foolishly paid for mercenaries. If you trust God and take care of God's business, God will take care of that for you. Verse number 10. Then Amaziah discharged the army that had come to him from Ephraim to go home again. And they became very angry with Judah and returned home in fierce anger. Now, why are they so mad? Well, they might get paid something out of the money that was given to their king, but it's certainly not going to be as much as they were hoping to get. Plus, all soldiers on campaigns got a cut of the plunder. They got a cut of the booty. Whenever you won, you collected all the stuff up from the losing side, and plus the war reparations, and all the soldiers got a big bonus out of that. So they figure they are going to miss out on all of those things, and that makes them mad. But verse 11, Amaziah took courage and he led out his people and he went to the Valley of Salt, that's the Dead Sea, and he struck down 10,000 men of Seir. These would be Edomites. Apparently, there was a problem with Edomites attacking Judah at this time. The men of Judah captured another 10,000 alive and took them to the top of a rock and threw them down from the top of the rock, and they were dashed to pieces. Now, one of the things that we presume, and I think correctly so, is that this was a military response of Judah against Edom for an attack, a surprise attack upon Judah. And that a whole bunch of Judeans had already been killed and Judean stuff had been taken. And so this is a reprisal operation. And so they capture some of the soldiers that were involved in the sneak attack upon Judah, and they execute them by throwing them off cliffs. Verse number 13, but the men of the army whom Amaziah sent back, not letting them go with him to battle, raided the cities of Judah from Samaria to Beth-horon, and they struck down 3,000 people in them and took much spoil. So those mercenaries caused a lot of trouble on their way out. That's also going to be held against them by the judgment of God as we move forward in this story. Now, getting ready for tomorrow, Amaziah makes a huge, huge mistake in the thing that he does once he defeats the Edomites. And it is what brings him down as a man and as a king. And it's just another illustration where good men can go bad if they don't stand strong in the faith.